Hey folks, and welcome to Dungeon Casters, the Dungeon Master Advice Show for Rookie DMs by Rookie DMs.
I'm Ben.
And I'm Scott.
And we're here to, we're going to help you with your campaign, and in 30 minutes, no, we do an hour?
An
Scott,
hour.
What do we do here?
It's an hour.
We do an hour. We're going to help you in an hour.
We're going to help you in an hour.
With whatever it is you need. Isn't that exciting?
That was a good one.
No, it wasn't.
That was probably one of our best.
It was poor. But that's important. Because that's what we're talking about today. Speech checks.
Speech checks, charisma checks, deception, intimidation, the other one.
Diplomacy.
That one.
Yep. It's going well.
Yeah, we're starting going off strong well. This week. So, those of you who follow our Twitter might have recently seen a tweet we posted about an idea we had where you roll before actually saying what you're intending to for a charisma check, and then role play the information there based on your roll. So if you roll like a 1, you say something really stupid, and if you roll a 20, you say something super charming and whatnot. And we got some people commenting back on the tweet saying, oh, I actually do the opposite, and or, oh, this is a cool idea, or, oh, I do this. And I think that it bears kind of looking into the real-world functionality of a lot of this RP stuff. So that's what we're going to be talking about this week. And to help us this week to talk about that, we have our player character expert, Alexander. He is a physicist who studied and got his master's in player character interactions.
Yeah, that's true. That was my concentration. I was a physicist, sort of, bachelor's in physics, and then my concentration was becoming an expert in charisma. And intimidation.
And intimidation. You can't see him, but he's 6'7".
Really strong.
He can bench a pickup truck.
Yes. Yeah,
and his calves are the size of watermelons.
Yes.
Yeah, he's a juicy man.
And very charismatic.
And very charismatic. He's got it all. So I think one of the things that struck us about this topic that made us want to talk about it with more depth was that in the game, a lot of the things that you can do, especially as it relates to skills, are all really kind of imagined things. It's like, oh, athletics. Like, you kind of just tell the DM what you're going to do, and you roll, you see how you do, they tell you how it goes. You know, like, the any of the saves, the dexterity saves, the will saves, so on and so forth. Any of that stuff is largely cinematic and can be described, and it either kind of happens or it doesn't happen based on the die roll. But anything that involves speaking part is kind of an anomaly in that, because, you know, whether or not a person is actually strong in real life or dexterous in real life is kind of irrelevant. It doesn't actually have much impact on the game. But somebody who is naturally very charismatic, but who's maybe not playing a character, has a strange experience with it, and vice versa. Somebody who isn't charismatic but is playing a charismatic character has a similarly strange experience where they are expected to, I suppose, interact to the best of their ability based on what their character can do, but it doesn't necessarily reflect how they actually speak or how good they are at being charismatic or intelligent or diplomatic about certain issues. And so you get in this weird zone of how do you manage somebody when social interaction is both a part of the outside game and the inside game. And where do you draw the line? And I know that you had said, you know, roll first and make the determination, and there was an opposite. Like, I let them decide what they want to say, and then I roll. And it's a kind of a weird issue, and it's one that I've gone back and forth on. And I think that there were your questions about, you know, is it fair to punish players who aren't naturally charismatic and who wouldn't necessarily know how to phrase a question to a ruler of a place or whatever, just because they don't know? Versus a person who is very charismatic, but who's playing a character who isn't, but they kind of can't help it because it's how they interact naturally.
Well, and I think that's the important bit about it, where you have the two varying schools of thought being kind of the traditional of say what you're going to say and then roll your dice, and then the dice decide everything, right? Mm-hmm. So even if you say, like, oh man, you should totally do this thing, and then you roll a 20, you convince that person for some reason of doing
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah.
And even if you're like, lay out a PowerPoint presentation with like bar graphs and like citing your sources, like MLA style and everything, and you roll a 1, no matter how good your argument was, it still means that that person's not convinced for some reason.
Yeah.
And the kind of way to deal with that initially would be the DM intrudes narratively. So, like, even if you said something really convincing, you could be like, oh, this guy's just, like, naturally stubborn. Or, like, he noticed something about your demeanor that led him to not trust you. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, vice versa. Maybe this guard is just, like, thick as a brick, so he trusts whatever you say. And he's like, okay, works for me. And while that is a, like, kind of the standard functioning style of it, I think that the problem with that is it adds an extra item on the DM's plate. It makes them have to think of more of the narrative, and any narrative control that the DM has is narrative control that the players don't.
Mm.
So a great way to keep your players invested, keep them involved, and keep them excited is to give them as much narrative control as possible. Which is where my idea came in, where you have the player roll the dice, and then acknowledge that a 1 is the worst, a 10 is the middle, and a 20 is the highest, so then they base what they say on that, and that allows for, like, a little bit of deeper role-playing where they can be truer to the character they're playing as opposed to just trying to win, and it can add a little comedy because you can say something really dumb and funny if you roll a 1, and then you get that, like, moment of brevity that might be a good break in attention.
Yeah.
I did mention before that we had someone who tweeted back at me when I tweeted this, that they actually have them say their argument and then give them advantage or disadvantage based on the merits of their argument, which I think is a neat idea if you have a certain type of party. But as Ben was saying before, you don't want to punish a naturally uncharismatic person for, you know, who is naturally charismatic in meat space in the real world in the game. So you want to be able to allow them to play the character they want if they want to play the charisma character, because they can't do that in real life. You don't want to penalize them because they're not good at it, because that's not fair. And, like,
right.
I'm going to tell you right now, I can't take, like, 6 stabs to the chest and lift a boulder over my head and smash it over someone's head, or, like, you know what I'm saying here. But I can play a barbarian and do all of those
right.
things.
Yeah.
So just because my human body and my, you know, trash goblin physique is limited by the real world, it doesn't mean that my characters have to be.
Trash goblin physique, Scott.
Yeah.
Stop the podcast. We have to make Scott feel better.
He doesn't.
Yeah, I guess it's interesting, because what you were just describing of having to, like, of saying your argument first, then rolling, I guess would kind of feel like it doesn't, how do I say it? It's like, oh, I have the opportunity now for you to maybe consider my argument. Does that make sense? Like,
yeah.
Like, oh, here's my point.
Yeah.
And then now I'm going to, it's like, it doesn't feel like, oh, this is my chance of success. It's like, are you even going to listen to me?
Yeah. Yeah. It's one of these weird things where
that's interesting.
Yeah, it is. And I've had to in the past draw finer lines on it than any other thing. Like, I don't make, you know, like I said, athletics, like I don't really make a lot of, like, you know, slivers about, like, oh, well, you didn't really flip the whole way. You know, that's a little ridiculous. You know, whereas I'm willing to make more concessions with the charisma stuff. Like, I would say that something that I'm fairly comfortable with is if a player brings to me a character who, you know, it's weird. Fifth edition has this thing where it's very infrequently you find anybody who's got a stat below a 10, right? It happens, but I haven't seen anything really lower than like an 8. most of the time. And 8 is, like, below average in the game. But it's, I don't think it's, like, stupid, right? Like, it's, like, you're not, like, the sharpest. You're not the most charismatic. Maybe you're a little brusque and kind of clumsy with your words. But it's also, like, you're not illiterate, you're not incompetent, you're not unable to think of things. And I think the weird thing is interaction with, like, an intelligence score, too, because somebody who can conceive of a plan or can conceive of an idea, the charisma is more the ability to express and convince upon that idea.
Yeah.
And you know, there's some things like, oh, can you charm this person? It's like, that's a very straight charisma thing, but a lot of things I feel are these kind of median zones between two skills. And a character who's got at least, like, an average intelligence is, I mean, I would say at least it's as smart as, like, your average person in the real world. I mean, the player, probably, who's like, well, I thought of this plan of, like, doing this thing, or I think the king would be really into this, or the queen said something about this earlier, like, there's no reason not to be able to pull it back. And I think just the effectiveness of explanation is the trouble. And so sometimes what I'm comfortable doing is, if the player can express to me what they want and they can present to me an argument, and it's reasonable, like, and it's not something that is, I kind of base on whether or not what they're trying to do is more outlandish than a fairly standard interaction, right? Like, if you're just talking to somebody and saying, like, hey, I think this is, like, kind of a cool idea, but you're a little clumsy with your words, but the idea is still at its core very sound and appealing to the other person, then I don't even know if I'd feel the necessity to make a roll. I think when I feel a roll coming on for that kind of stuff, it has to do with, like, you know, like, this isn't in this person's favor, or this is a very confusing way to go about it, or there's reason they would be suspicious. Then I start asking for the roll. But when it comes to the straight idea, I don't necessarily feel the need to force them to dumb themselves down or to give of themselves more than can be really expected. Because I find that line is very hard to tread and be, frankly, polite about it, you know? Because I think everyone's like, oh, I like you said, I can't lift boulders, but I'm fine with that. But being like, I want to be charismatic, but I'm being actively punished in some cases because I can't actually explain what my character could otherwise explain. So
does this stop at charisma, or is this just, you know, any sort of skill check in general?
I mean, in this case, we're talking more about charisma, but I mean, what did you have in
mind? I was thinking of Superba Gelato.
Character. Alex had a character named Superba Gelato.
I think it's a valid, you know, it's a valid thing to bring up, because, like, the whole point was that he was a, you know, like, a super spy, and his disguise kit was the same disguise, no matter what.
Oh, yeah.
No matter who or what he was impersonating, it was the same disguise. Yeah. Right? Now, you let me do that.
Yeah.
But, like, that would never work.
Fly.
Like,
never.
If you have a high enough, you know, charisma, if you can pass those checks, and this is where that, like, well, is this 20 or whatever, you know, this 14 that I'm rolling, is that indicative of how convincing this is to you, the DM, or to the world, right?
Yeah. Like, where is the line?
Well, I think the bottom line with that is an understanding of the difficulty setting, or the difficulty, like, challenge rating of each dice roll for a skill check, where, like, you have a 5 being a basic difficulty task that has almost no possibility of failure, 10 being an average, 15 being difficult, 20 being almost impossible, 25 being virtually impossible, and 30 being you forgot to bring the DM snacks. Like, you have to understand, like, think about it in a logical way. You have, like, that 14 you rolled, that's an above average, but it's not, like, a very difficult situation. So if you had to convince someone that you were the Baroness Eclair while you were wearing the same mustache and glasses they met you in 10 minutes ago.
That was a great, like, name, Scott.
That would probably be closer to a 25.
Baroness Eclair. It's a good name. I hear what you're saying.
It is.
Yeah, I hear what
you're doing this for a while.
Yeah, no, I hear what you're saying. It is. It is a strange thing. I
guess it depends on the DM too, right?
It does depend on the DM, like you said.
And what kind of campaign you're trying.
Yeah, I mean, I was willing to let that slide because it was very sort of lighthearted.
Right.
But I understand that there's going to be people who, like, will have more problem with that. Yes. That it's like, well, it's not reasonable what you're doing, no. You know? And, like, that's another thing is, like I kind of said, sort of, is, like, there is a level of, like, I sometimes will only bring in skill checks and especially social checks where they would be above and beyond the call of duty. You know what I mean? Like where it would be strange to say something like to lie boldly in someone's face,
right?
You know, and to then expect them to accept it, you know, I'll ask them to do a check on that. But I think too, forgot what I was going to say. I think too, what was it? Yeah, hold on. I had a really interesting thing to say about that. Oh dear, no! Somebody cut me off.
That was a good point.
Yeah, that was a great point. We cut it out in editing. That's why
we lost it.
It sounds yeah, like you it lost. Really got well. Lost in the editing tunnel.
What happened?
Damn.
Well, I mean, I think it's definitely a gray area, and the bottom line is like the best advice to give is to take a look at your party and take a look at the campaign you're running, because it is one of those things that I personally would recommend to be a house rule where you have to find out what works best for you. Now, if you pop open the Dungeon Master's Guide and Player's Handbook, you can figure out how to do it like by the book 5e rules, and that might be fine. Or if you feel that like one of the other ways we mentioned or some other way y'all do it at home just like works better, I think that the whole point of the openness of D&D is that you can alter the rules with those little kind of minuscule differences. The best example being, I don't know any table that runs critical hits the same way, where sometimes it's just roll all the dice, total it, and double it. Sometimes it's roll 2 of the damage dice. Sometimes it's roll all the dice and just double the dice without modifiers. So there's all these different little, like, it achieves the same thing. You hit extra hard, but it's just a different way of getting to that.
Yeah, and either I remember what I was
more
say,
or less rewarding.
I think with that kind of check, with your charisma, I think it's important to, if there's any confusion, and it's in some cases just the DM's responsibility to check for this kind of confusion, regardless of whether or not you're certain you understand, a player says, like, this is what I say. And a good question is, tell me what you want to happen, or what is your reason for saying this way? Because what they might tell you is, like, oh, I'm trying to appeal to this particular thing. And so you'll say, like, well, I have to accept that this is what they tried to do. Maybe they as a person just didn't sort of see a clear path to that conversation. It's just like not in their nature to be this kind of diplomatic person, whatever, or they're not naturally intimidating, you know, whatever it is. So having this conversation in which you ask the player, what did you want to happen? What's your point of saying this? What are you attempting to do in specific sort of out of character terms? So that when you roll, you're rolling against how effective that intention was against the other person's reasons to reject it. So I think clarifying confusion on a very kind of structural level when it comes to this kind of stuff is important, because I think there's so much room for confusion with a charisma check, because somebody's got an intention, they frame it in the character. They're like two or three steps removed from themselves already. They're appealing to what they think they know of a fake person, and then you're having to interpret what you assume they want out of that interaction, and then repeat or then sort of reciprocate conversation back. And so I think breaking it down to its base components and saying, like, all right, when you said that, what was your goal? What did you want? And what are you trying to do with your phrasing? Is just a great way to have at least a better understanding of how to respond and understand what your player is after.
Right. I guess to a certain extent, I mean, you are trying to charm the DM as much as you're trying to charm the character, right? Because, like, while you were talking, I was thinking, like, well, like, what's stopping me from, if I roll, being like, oh, I'm just going to tell you what I'm trying to do. I'm not going to try to come up with something to say. I'm just like, hey, this is what I'm trying to do.
Yeah.
Right. But then there's no, like, there's no role playing aspect. So like, yeah, I guess, I mean, how separable are those two things of, yeah, that line between, like, who am I trying to convince? Am I trying to convince this person or am I trying to convince you?
Yeah. I mean, DMs like to have their characters role play. Yeah. You know, I mean, it sucks a lot of joy out of the game when you're just kind of saying like, oh, I want to deceive this person into thinking this.
Here's a stripped down sort of analysis.
Yeah.
I'm trying to appeal to these attributes. You're like a weird bat.
Well, and I mean, here's the thing with that. Like most relationships, communication is key.
Throw some real wisdom in there.
Oh, yeah. I like to sprinkle that in a little bit every now and again. But I think that the bottom line is the system is vague.
Yes.
For the idea of, in real life, and a charisma interaction of that nature is also vague. Like, if you think about the situation pulled into the modern world of, like, there is a doorman at this club that I want to get into, and I have to convince him to let me into the club. If I'm going to intimidate that human being... There's a lot of factors involved that make it a gray area. Or if I'm going to charm him into letting me in, also, lots of factors that are involved. Like, I don't know, is he afraid of spiders? Can I use that to intimidate him? I don't know, maybe. Am I bigger than him? Probably not. So, like, that's not going for me. So if I'm trying to charm him, does he like me? Does he think I'm cute? I don't know these things. So it's a rough kind of gray area. And I know a couple episodes ago, Ben and I talked about Little Light, the game I've been, designing and making myself for a while. And, Alex, but like...
I'm sorry.
I built the speech system in that game to literally be functioning as a puzzle.
Yeah.
So there are like specific moving parts to it and specific challenges and hard numbers. So that does pull you out of the role play a little bit, but it turns it into, unless you're in a specific speech puzzle type interaction, all the talking is just freeform.
It's just
natural. There is no role. There's no implication. But when it's like, oh, you have to convince this person of this thing or get this information out of this person, you have a set challenge and you have to roll dice in a row and that kind of thing. So it builds it into... like a mini game when there's a like strong consequence, but for the most of the time you just get a free form talk.
Do you find that's better? Do you find that is it more difficult when you're trying to convince somebody of something in that situation? Because then it really is, right? If I understand it correctly, it really is just like, I'm trying to convince you, Scott, of something that I want to do.
Mm.
Do you find it easier does it make more sense? Is it more sort of like
intuitive?
So the way the system works,
streamlined,
is there's like high rolls and low rolls, and like let's say the low roll is a 3, the high roll is a 5. If you roll a 3 or higher, it's going to give you like basically what you want. If you roll a 5 or higher, it's going to give you more to what you want. But the math and the like puzzle aspect come to it of the person you're talking to's opinion of you. If they don't like you, that'll raise those numbers. If they do like you, it'll lower those numbers. So the argument not necessarily becomes irrelevant, because if you talk in their favor, that will, if the plan ends up in their favor, that will lower the numbers you have to hit. But the bottom line is there's a lot of like hard number functionality that like is irrelevant to the argument. So the argument's just one piece.
This kind of goes into that tweet you guys got then of hearing the argument first and then giving sort of, you know, pluses or minuses depending, right? Like having it be, I guess maybe it's easier for the DM in that way to, like, once they hear the argument, they can be like, well, this is the person they're talking to. Now I can try to figure out that person's motivation, what they would want.
Yeah. I mean, I think... If the context of that is the person sort of explains the argument, like they give an argument, but then they explain sort of, like I said, the intention of that argument, and then it's one thing. But I think it is a risk to sort of have your players role play out a character they may or may not be like on par with socially.
Sure, sure.
And then to give them demerits for skills that they should have but don't.
Right, but they're role playing.
They are role playing, but like you can only go as far as you're able.
Right.
And the trouble with the game is like it's built for people who are kind of, or it's not built for people. It's built, the characters you play in game tend to be way above and beyond the norm.
Right.
So you end up in this thing where like even very charismatic people or very strong people, very dexterous people, they're not really even on par with like what a fifth level character will be able to do.
Right.
And so, you know, there's only so far it goes, I guess. And I worry a little bit about, I don't know.
Well,
it's almost, I would say it's insulting, but it's like a little, I imagine if I was like, I don't really feel comfort with like socializing, but I want to play a social character. And I gave an argument and the DM said like, that wasn't very good. You're getting disadvantaged. I'd be like, okay,
sorry, buddy.
Like,
just
what am I supposed to do with that?
It's not charming enough.
Yeah.
You're just too awkward of a person.
You're too awkward as a person. Yeah. And I'm like, well, that's,
like you specifically, not your character,
but
like
that's,
you.
But we're talking about my character.
Yeah.
Like, Ben is a very awkward person.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
that's why he has this issue.
Yeah.
But I think the way I kind of tried to solve that was break down characters into a handful of, like, specific distinct personalities.
Sure.
So, like, one of the personalities is mercenary that I have in my game. So their major motivation is money. So if you are able to figure out this person is a mercenary type personality, you know, like, oh, my argument should either be bribing them or in some way get them more money, and then that's how I do the benefit. So then you think of, it doesn't have to necessarily be very, you know, convincing or charismatic, but you can just be like, hey, let me explain to you, I will give you this money if you let me do this thing. And they'll be like, okay, well, this is my personality type. I like money. So if you give me this money, you can do the thing. So it is that kind of whole pigeonhole or like wormhole of generalizing people into like specific categories. And then the fewer categories you have, the easier it is to function, but also the less diverse the game. So you kind of got to find that middle ground, which is what I'm trying to like work on right now and figure out. But I think if you can water a NPC down to their primary motivation in regards to the interaction, then it doesn't have to be necessarily a charismatic argument as long as it appeals to their motivation.
I wonder, though, I mean, that, but isn't that kind of the sort of dilemma? Because the ability to do that requires, like, to be like, oh, this character is feeling this, I'm going to try to appeal to their, I mean, that does require, as a person, a certain understanding of how, you know, like, that's kind of why a charismatic person is charismatic in the first place. But so, like, you kind of have to already be charismatic to understand. Not necessarily, but, like, there is a certain amount of...
Yeah, there is an interpersonal understanding that has to already be in place.
I find it beneficial to try to use charisma in the game and then intimidation in real life when it comes to trying to get my charisma checked.
Well, and that's the thing, is that's why I kind of water it down for the player in the moment where they have an opportunity to roll essentially in my game. It's not called an insight check, but it is equivalent in D&D an insight check at the beginning of this conversation. And if they succeed, they know that player's motivations. But if they fail, it's kind of just like, all right, well, this is now a crapshoot. I'm not going to get a bonus from this. So I have to either convince them to like me or do something else to get the upper hand in this
argument.
Yeah,
I think it's important to remember, too, that this kind of conversation, which I think is important, I think a lot of people struggle with, like, has this weird, like, shadow behind it that D&D is a game. And we've said that often in the context of, like, hey, like, don't take it seriously to the point of, like, insulting other people, or don't let it become this, like, burden upon you. But in this context, I mean, like, this is a game. This is a thing that has rules. It can be played. It's intended to be played. It's Monopoly, just more complicated, right? And so it's not a life simulator. Do you know what I mean? Like, it can be. I mean, you can make a game that is that, but it's not structured. It's not built from the ground up with the idea that it will be like a one-for-one replication of what it's really like to have a conversation with somebody, and you'll have to sort of present yourself in this way. And I think that there's, I don't know, maybe it's fifth edition's push towards like a narrative focus that has made, while they've condensed the numbers, it's made this sort of, it's like become more granular in its action. And so like, while you're saying like, there is a level of just, I have to consolidate people into like, mercenaries want money. Like, does every single mercenary in the entire world and all throughout history only exclusively care about money and nothing else? Like, no, of course not. Right. But also, none of these people are real. They're figures in a game that you are using as pawns. I mean, they are like literally pawns in a game.
Yeah.
And so, while no, it doesn't represent humanity.
Right.
It also isn't necessarily supposed to. I mean, change it up. Give your players a surprise. That's important just from like a fun perspective. But it's also like, if your aim is to create the most accurate simulator of what it's honestly like to have a conversation.
Oh, it's a nightmare.
It's a nightmare. You can't do it.
Yeah.
Oh, you mean have a conversation.
Well, just in general.
Well, so make it hell, and then it'll be accurate.
I think
it's all very confusing. But I think it's an important point. It's like, this is never going to function the way you think it should. And there's just going to have to be leeway accepted at the gate.
Right.
I think that's a good final statement on this kind of situation. Is that
you closed it out.
it is, you know, you do have to acknowledge it as a game. Now, I know Ben and I talked about another kind of aspect of real world personality, culture, and mentality colliding with fantasy world, and we're going to get to that in a second, but first, I want to take advantage of our character, player, expert, Alex,
like, we don't have any
and
spiders.
Ask you a
this
question
you
directly.
By
this Pabst, I'm drinking.
By Streamcast.
By Streamcast.
I'm sorry, Scott.
So, basically the theme of tonight's episode, right, is the problems that you have connecting to a game with your real-world brain, right? Your real-world ego and all that stuff. No, I don't mean you specifically. I mean, like, in general, like, that's...
you don't want to hear about that. That's all right.
My question is, what has been the hardest aspect as a player of D&D to kind of understand and conceptualize to get yourself into the mindset of role-playing?
Yeah, I think for me, the frustration I've always had when, especially for you know, speech checks or intelligence checks and stuff like that, is just not knowing, like, there's a whole world that's been created for me, right? Where it's like, these people all have motivations, they all have, you know, personalities and things that they want, and I guess that's a motivation. Anyway, they have motivations. And it's sort of entering into that and not really understanding a lot about the world, so it almost feels like trying to get around in, like, a different country, you know? Where you're like, I don't really know too much about this, like, but if I, like, took the time and, like, studied the world that was created, be like, okay, I can sort of understand how these people feel and how these people feel. It almost feels like catching up is difficult. So when I'm talking to, like a guard, I'm just like, hey, how's your day going? You know,
what you doing?
What are you into? Like, what do you like?
Sports.
I like sports. But it does, it's always been tough for me to, like, understand, like, well, like political motivations, right? Mm. It's like, okay, you have these two warring factions, but it's like, oh, yes, and maybe you know why, but it's like, there's more nuance. It's like, I can't just be like, yeah, those guys, we don't like them, right? And everyone's like, yeah, we don't like them either. It's like, great, we're all friends now. This is fantastic. So when it comes to making a good argument, like, any sort of good argument is, you know, backed up with a certain amount of, you know, factual knowledge about what's going on. And maybe not a certain amount. I mean, a good argument is factual knowledge about what's going on. So yeah, I guess that's always been tough for me, is like knowing enough about the actual situation to, and that might just be like, missing things, right? Yeah.
Well, and I think a distinct part of it for you on a personal level might be the fact that
that's
you're more
true.
Of a sci-fi guy than a fantasy guy.
I think fantasy is for nerds.
And so there are fantasy tropes that, like, Ben and I are, like, very intimately acquainted with that are not part of your,
right. Yeah, no, that's very true.
You know, media consumption. They're not part of your, like, everyday experience.
It's fair, but I do definitely see what you're saying. It's if you're going to interact with the world at all in a substantial and meaningful and interesting way, it benefits you to know something about it.
Yeah.
And when the world's been completely invented, and especially in the early stages of a game where really
especially
nothing's been revealed
in
any big way, there's like the hints of a story, there's like a few people you've heard of. Like, where do you really start with that? Because it's assumed that the character will... it's assumed that the character will, you know, like, have grown up in this place and so therefore have a knowledge... which is probably true, and that's where, like, you know, personal history, you know, history checks, and so on and so forth come in. But the player themselves is still dealing with a tremendous lack of knowledge.
Sure.
And
so,
I mean, they can ask questions, but
but
it's also, like, when you're dealing with something that's completely foreign, it's like, I don't even know what questions to ask. And what, I mean, it almost sometimes turns into, what am I asking is, like, what's the entire detailed history of the last 50 years of where I'm standing.
Yeah, give me the encyclopedia of this place in like 2 weeks, and then maybe I'll have an informed decision. Maybe.
Yeah.
Or I'll be crippled by, you know, analysis.
Well, and that's the thing is, I know some...
Yeah, absolutely.
I know some DMs that do that. Like, one of the podcasts I listen to, God's Fall, is DM'd by Aram Vartian, who is an unbelievable world builder, and... the first episode of his podcast was literally him speaking alone about the history of just the pantheon of the gods of the world. So, like, the general world history of, like, the origins of the Earth, but, like, he had 25 straight minutes of just, like, how the pantheon came to be and who got with who to give birth to the next god and all this stuff, and, like, it is impossible to have your group of players sit down while you deliver 4 hours of straight exposition, because that's like the worst college class ever.
There's one thing the players love.
So it is.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. Yeah.
It is definitely like a DM problem to be like, how do I integrate enough exposition that my players can function in this world and at the same time not bore them to tears? And I think the easiest way to do that is apparent in Dungeons & Dragons 4th edition. Because 4th edition was the edition that everyone hates.
I didn't play it enough to make a huge decision.
I kind of like it. And, but like, I thought it was okay. Mm. I liked it because it's a great learning edition. Everything is watered down. Basic, it's basically a card game
that
because
was
all your abilities are on little cards.
That was genius,
and
by the way,
it's great. It was a great idea, but it was great for, you know, starting players, right? It was great for people who had never tried a role playing game before because it made the rules really easy to grasp, and the natural setting of 4th edition was a very low magic world, and I think that. That is one of the easiest ways to kind of remove that issue of exposition is if you make the world as similar to our world as possible. Now, it's always going to be different because magic always exists, but, like, and this was the other topic Ben and I wanted to talk about, is, like, the implications of a world where magic exists is, like, ridiculous to society. Every single aspect of society will be completely different if magic existed. So, like, it's a ridiculous undertaking to design that world, and an even more ridiculous undertaking to be able to act and exist and live in that world with none of this knowledge.
it is a huge challenge. I mean, it's so hard from DM perspective to build it in such a way that it sort of speaks for itself and it's kind of self-explanatory. And it's very hard from a player perspective to run in essentially blind to an entire planet. It's like being born at age 30. Yeah. You know, it's just like, okay.
Who am I?
So we did want to talk about all this sort of this idea of what the world might look like. And this is of course going to be up to you ultimately. But I think that I every time I go to build a campaign, I am very conscious of this, what I feel is a disconnect. And that's every time I think about a world that has been from the very beginning, like steeped in magic and people could use it and it would affect the world in all kinds of ways, it's almost been like I couldn't figure out how it would ever succeed beyond, like, I don't know, like just amoeba floating in ooze, because it would be so dangerous all the time and shit would be exploding without, like, you know, and things becoming like sentient at like rapid and weird rates and people suddenly coming across like world-ending amounts of power that they like just could not control. And that's always been very strange to me. So, you know, that's a very cataclysmic way to think about it. But I think it is important to consider when you're building a world sort of the influence that magic has, because there's this phrase I have for myself about a lot of things, usually with writing, but also it comes in D&D. And it's like wading into the waters of the absurd. And I always have this belief that, like, you get to go about 10% in before you really start alienating people.
Right.
And 10% is not that much. It's a pretty good amount in terms of what you can get away with, but it's not that far. And so, you know, you get to be like you said, it's like, it's going to be reflective of our world. It's going to have buildings that are generally vertical,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, longer buildings that are horizontal, but it's going to be like, they're not going to just be, you know, a building that's floating in the air and also doesn't exist in our time and also like is semi-transparent and also like is made out of a material that doesn't exist.
Right.
And also like there's this building effect of like, yeah, it's very magical and it's very unique, but I have no idea how to interact with this. But, you know, the game has this, everything's kind of magic and it's pretty steeped in magic. And there's enough spells of like world ending capacity that I'm like, I don't know, like, you got to be really wary of a bunch of people who spend enough time learning time stop. You know, like, that's not good, guys. You know?
Even on, like, the ground level, too. Sorry, I was just thinking about, like, you know that sort of classic image of, like a wizard using magic to, like, clean the house?
Yeah.
With, like, but they're, like, they're manipulating, like, a broom. And yeah. It's like, why would the broom exist in the first place? Like, that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's like, so you're still sweeping, but you, like, I feel like you're not using this power to, like, okay.
You built a tool that was built for hands.
Exactly.
And then you use magic to not use your hands.
What?
Broom exists for the normies. The magic people use it to humor them.
But they're just being nice?
Yeah, I guess. I don't know.
Well, we gotta give money to the local broom shop. They, you know.
I know. No, but I wonder, these are.
Yeah, like, why, there's stuff that just wouldn't exist, right? Oh, or would there be much less of it? Wouldn't be as, you know, as ubiquitous.
Yes.
I think one of the, like, biggest things to look at with magic, obviously, because D&D takes place in the fantasy setting defaulting in the medieval period, which was a very war-torn and tumultuous period, right?
Yeah.
Warfare would be ridiculously different than it is now.
Yeah.
Because if you had people that had the ability to, like, level buildings...
Summon tornadoes and, like, of swords.
Suits of armor, just don't even bother. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
You might as well
run out there naked.
You're gonna be boiled from the inside.
You have people who can just, like, snap their fingers and control your mind.
Yeah.
And, like, you're supposed to be, like... Yeah, but I got this really neat sword.
Magic missile!
But my noble steed.
Yeah. I mean, it is strange. I mean, this has been a sort of issue with D&D forever. That's like, it's kind of like, well, spellcasters are kind of like, I mean, wouldn't you want to be, though? Wouldn't you want to just do everything?
Spellcasters are great.
So it's yes, they are. And it's a weird question to ask. I mean, I think when determining the level of magic in your world, like, high magic is cool, I think, at an aesthetic level.
Right.
But there are practical problems that, like, you and your players will just have to gloss over in great quantities to make sense of. You know, it's like, especially with spells as practical as, like, create food and water, it's like no one would ever have to farm again. Like, if people of general capacity could do this, like, well, that's it.
That is willful negligence of basic human rights.
Yeah. And so I think, you know, maybe, like you said, with 4th edition, low magic tends to be easier because it's more reflective of a world that we know.
Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably worth considering, even though it may not look as exciting from the outside. There is a level of control and of smallness and of familiarity that exists in a low magic setting. It's like, oh, like, these exist, but very few people are really capable of doing this. And it's like, you know, if you have the power to, like, see the future, it's like, you're really not going to spend your time doing, like, all this other stuff, you know? Like, Fireball is not really of concern to somebody whose job it is to, like, tell fortunes, you know? Right. I mean, or the amount of just effort it takes to do these things is so high and so exhausting that it's like, yeah, I mean, you can do it, but, like, you're not going to want to do it two times in a row because you might not be conscious afterwards. I mean, the players are one thing. You know, they get kind of special rights, but also they're built, like I said, heroically.
Yeah, they're supposed to be
they
heroes.
Are abnormal in most games. And so, but your average person, you know, maybe they get to, like, second level magic, but it's just like, beyond that point, the second level magic's pretty strong, you know? I mean, the stuff is already up there. And so beyond that point, it almost is like, I mean, think about it in the context of our real world. It's like, yeah, I mean, how many people are, like, professional bodybuilders? It's like, yeah, I mean, we all, like, technically, like, have some capacity to get there. We all, like, could put in the time, and in certain ways it would be a great asset to our lives to be that strong. But, like,
opening jars
by crushing them, you know, opening your car door by crushing it.
By just completely removing it.
Yeah. So, but
you don't need to commute to work. You can just jump and you're there.
Have you seen that? It's crazy.
Yeah. It's amazing. Yeah. I saw this documentary called The Hulk. And I don't know why we're all not doing
it's
that.
It's insane.
But anyway, I think that, you know, if you make that comparison, it's like, yeah, I mean, if you could study enough to be a wizard of enormous skill, that would be great. But, like, there's a reason people don't do. I mean, how many, like, people could actually achieve that? And who would want to put in that much time? I mean, most people in the world don't want to put in that much time in anything because it's just not practical. You know, it's like, if you are actually a farmer, it's like, I don't have time to sit down and, like, study spellbooks for six hours a day. I'm, like, exhausted, you know? So when you're building your world and you're considering the level of magic, again, consider that, like, you can just do transplants of, like, high magic, you know, into low magic. Like, oh, we don't go fox hunting. We go, like, owl bear hunting. Like, we ride griffins to work. You know, like, you can do that. But there are weird implications when it comes especially to spell casting. I think of, like, how people would build buildings. And it's like, why would they even be on the ground?
Why have staircases?
Yeah. I mean, why even have buildings? I mean, at that point, like, everybody could probably astral project.
Yeah, just, like, I don't know.
Just meet in, like, the ether.
Yeah, in Second Life.
In Second Life. You know, and it's a very strange thing.
I think that everyone has their own solutions to this, whether they acknowledge them as solutions to this problem or not.
Right.
For example, my two go-tos are, aesthetically, I'm super into steampunk, and aesthetically, I'm super into Inquisition and witch hunts.
Yeah.
So, magic is always persecuited in my environment.
Aesthetically into witch hunts.
Always
aesthetically
persecuted.
Into witch hunts, yeah. I'm artistically into witch hunts.
Inquisition.
And you can sub in high magic settings with steampunk tech. Now, like, the greatest example of a high magic setting would be Eberron. That is, like, the quintessential current high magic setting, right? You have things like Warforged, which is a race that only exists because there was so much fucking magic, all these people that were fighting created robots out of magic to fight for them, which is, like, super dope, but now the war's over, and they have this race of sentient
military
armor
robots
that they made.
Just a lot of veterans walking around with, you know, dejected,
yeah, working, they're
in.
Working minimum wage jobs.
If they can get a minimum wage job.
If they can get them, exactly. And there's open animosity towards them, which
no,
is ridiculous.
Gross.
So you have, as opposed to a magic-powered train, you have a steam-powered
I thought you were
going
to say a train
so that way you
pulled
don't
by
have
a bunch
rely
of military robots. I was like, that's really cool.
That's pretty rad, yeah.
I think technology is a good substitute when you want to have that like high magic, really like high whimsy feel, but you don't want to have the consequences of like, well, people can just create blizzards if they're like bored enough because it's cataclysmic. I mean, really, like magic beyond fifth level is cataclysmically powerful. I mean, I think I was listening to something and they were like, yeah, like a wizard of sufficient power can cast a fireball and wipe out like thousands of people. And it's like, oh boy, like probably not a lot of people should have that amount of power in my world. It's like you can't have everybody walking around being a nuclear bomb. It's like nothing would survive.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
And this is more hypothetical. I don't know if it totally relates, but like, do you think there's a level of like this sort of mutually assured destruction, right? Like if a number of people can go around casting Swordnados, right?
Yeah.
Like, do you think there's
a
level
spell,
like,
I don't know, like, that's like, real.
Let's maybe ease off on this and not like get anybody too tense, right?
Yeah. I mean, probably. I mean, that's probably the only way to deal with it. There's a world in which the highest magic setting is one that's much more of like low scale individualized political espionage.
Okay.
Like, because if everyone is capable of this hugely destructive force, it's like, well, we can't piss them off because they can do that.
Right.
We can't
piss
them off.
Right.
And everybody's just divining on each other, trying to figure out what they're going to do next.
Right.
And actually, nothing really moves.
It's like the Solarians in Mass Effect, right? Like, it's just all subterfuge.
Yeah.
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 The only way in is to be like, let's send one person who can sneak under all of this.
Let's use no magic.
Yeah.
And just destroy them economically.
I mean, yeah, because if everyone's out there looking for... If everyone's out there looking for, like, the next high magic problem,
then what's
the solution? It's like, you send a bunch of, like, people who are not magical in, because they're not going to be seen.
Oh, but that explains the swords. They just send regular armies. They just wind up having regular wars.
I mean, at some point, it might turn back on that.
Yeah.
Weird, right?
All right, full circle, then.
Yeah. And it's definitely, if it could make it to a point, like, if the civilization could make it to a point where they would be able to sort of have political treaties.
Yeah.
Then you might end up with, like, all right, we're just going to send regular people in, because what's going to happen is we're just going to douse each other in thunderstorms 365 days a year until everything's dead.
We're going to keep sending robots in and have just an ultimately consequenceless war forever.
This is getting a little too real.
I'd say.
Well, I mean, there is... in that regard, I think that the solution... that you used for your campaign that we got off the ground and never really finished...
The theme.
which was the idea of using high magic as a setting, you know, as a aesthetic, and, like, honestly... ignoring the
implications.
Yeah,
you really,
like,
at some point,
you
kind of have to if you're going to sit there with it.
Because, like, we were in medieval times, we started out on a giant fantasy cruise ship.
Yeah, that's true.
The restaurant.
You did. Based on, I think, the Royal Caribbean or something. I don't remember. Carnival? Maybe it was.
Yeah, we were literally on a cruise ship, and then we were zipping around in a limo
with no horses
and a turbojet.
It was all magic, though. You hadn't come in.
I was like, I do not remember this.
Yeah, you would have liked it, but you weren't there.
Okay, sorry.
Yeah, that was when we were, like, really close to the plot of Men in Black, and we essentially had the Men in Black car, but it was just a medieval carriage with no horses.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the substitute was nice. I mean, I agree with you. It's just, that was, like, an aesthetic I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there was a level of, like, we're going to accept that, like, hags are a problem. We're going to accept that, like, phantoms are real and a big issue. We're going to accept that people can just do these things and that there's enough of them that they will continue to be a problem for you as you get stronger. But there is also a lot of turning the other way when it comes to, like, you know, the classic question of, like, well, if there's enough wizards out there who can cast time stop, like, how did we ever even get this far? You know, like,
yeah.
Like we never stood a chance. Like, what have they been doing the whole time? Like, how come their machinations haven't come true? And you just have to be like, because they haven't, because they're lazy or somewhere else.
Or responsible.
Or their crazy plan hasn't reached its peak yet.
Who's to know if morality isn't, like, basic ingrained human ethics and morality are not what's keeping the world in place? Maybe people are not all pieces of trash at their core, and they can, without having to answer to a higher power, police and organize themselves.
That's very true. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, I think...
That was so carefully put, Scott.
you know what, this is a different argument, but I agree. I think, you know, maybe there is a certain amount of, like, yeah, there is a responsibility here, and, like, you're using this as an example of how to explain why things aren't, like, in this world of, you know, seemingly limitless power,
yeah,
why, like,
how okay, it got off the ground.
Right. Let's say I was walking around in this world, and it's like, wow, there's another day where I just can't account for most of it. You know? like all of a sudden, like, everything is different again. Like, it's so confusing. So the solution you're saying is, or a possible solution is that there is a moral accountability that people have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I also think that I have made the mistake of. Like, if you go to the handbook and you look at the spells, like, a lot of these actually really do have very hard limits. And we don't follow, oftentimes, like, material components. But if you're going to have a high magic setting, I think it's worth considering, like, yeah, you don't just get to cast, like, you know, Revivify. Like, you need... I don't remember if it's Revivify that needs this, but, like, if you want to bring back the dead, like, you really do need a $10,000 diamond to do it.
Revivify is a $1,000 diamond... True Resurrection, I believe, is the $25,000
right. So, like, if you're gonna have a world in which this stuff is prevalent, and maybe not common, but also not uncommon, I think it's worth taking the spells as they're listed very seriously and being like, okay, to do this, you need the vocal component, you need the hand component, you need 2 hours to cast it, you need really rare things. Rare enough that, like, I mean, how many $25,000 diamonds do we really, like, have?
You okay. Know,
like,
yeah,
like,
yeah.
It's there are limiters in
so
place.
Esoteric.
Right, there's limiters in place. And also, a lot of these spells, as they get to higher levels and very high powers, they don't last forever. You know, Time Stop has a time limit on how long it lasts. And even something like Wish, the strongest spell in the game, you know, that can do anything. Well, okay, it can do anything. I mean, I'd be hard-pressed to find something that's better. Anyway, there's, like, there's a risk that it, like, doesn't work and you can never cast it again. You know what I mean? Like, these things do have parameters in place to prevent this. So it's possible people who have tried this have just, you know, maybe upped the odds of how bad it can go. And it's like, oh, yeah, either, you know, it's a great thing if it goes for you, but you have as likely a chance to die or never be able to cast this again.
Okay.
So, so you have a 1 in 3 shot at this going off without a major consequence.
One day I'll build up the confidence to cast Revivify.
Yeah.
One day I'll do it.
I mean, at a human level, that's kind of what happens. It's like I can cast Wish, but I might die.
Yeah. Or I'll lose $25,000.
Yeah. Or I just won't be able to do it again and nothing happens. Yeah. And I lose any opportunity to use this when I need it.
I think another important aspect of this to bring up, and I know we're running close on time here, but I just want to pop this in. Dungeons & Dragons assumes a polytheistic pantheon that is very
invested in this world. They're not nice, and they're really strong.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, they're dumb. That's a really good point. They, yeah.
they like they have their fucking agendas yeah. and they don't deviate from that. And the other thing is, like, you look at, for example, a lich. Now, no lich starts out being like, I'm going to be the most evil. But yeah. it's like always a person who's just like a very powerful wizard.
Die.
And it's like, I'm going to get all of this power and help all these people and like end world hunger with all of my power. And then they kill themselves to become a lich. And then when they come back, the power is too much and it corrupts them and drives them insane. And then they become like uber evil. So the aspect of like, all right, so someone's like has all this magic, this world altering, changing magic. They're like, all right, the ultimate step I can take is become a lich and then change the world. And then they become a lich. And before they change the world, some group of heroes comes along and is like, yo, dude, you're a fucking lich.
Wow.
Kick his ass. And then
Wait,
they kill
hold
him.
On. The players are actively making the world a worse place.
In some cases.
This person was going to end world hunger.
And
they
said, like, no,
potentially.
You're evil.
They sacrificed the flesh. They sacrificed their body to do this.
Yeah.
And then, oh my god, that's
yeah.
disgusting.
Horrible, right? And I think to that same point with the gods,
the gods.
Like, the gods have agents, very powerful agents. Like, they're not going to come down themselves. And it's like, especially gods of magic and things like that, they're going to be like, yeah, you don't get to just use this.
Yeah.
Like, you, no, no, no,
yeah,
no, 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 no,
yeah.
no. Like, the god of life is here, the god of death is here, the god of magic is here, and they're not
yeah.
really too pleased that you're out here, like, altering time space every other day.
Listen, Buster, that's our job.
Yeah, so, I mean, they're going to send, like, frankly, angels down to kick your
yeah,
ass.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of those celestial and demonic monsters are exceedingly powerful. Especially, you know, not saying that this is a player problem immediately, it can become one, but like, in thinking of like why your world hasn't fallen apart, it's like, well, because every time somebody reaches this point, like a bunch of angels come down and kill them so it doesn't go any farther than this. You know?
Yeah.
Which is a potential.
I mean, that's, it's a good fix, right? It's a really good
yeah.
fix. It, I mean, it makes it really solves a lot of problems.
It does.
Just like it does in real life.
Just like it does in real life. When things get too out of control, the angels come down and kill whoever's
yeah.
responsible.
Yeah, exactly. No, but in terms of like, oh, this solves a lot of philosophical problems.
It's
yes.
literal
and it solves a lot of problems
machina.
Here. It's like, yeah, no, that, I mean, that's a great argument, honestly. It's like, it's a catch-all. Like it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Gods are good.
Hell yes. Can I say that?
Yeah.
Oh, I can say hell. Oh, it's marked as explicit.
Yeah.
Hell yeah.
He just dropped the F-bomb like twice.
He did?
Yeah.
You potty mouth. Unbelievable.
All right. I think that's it. All right.
So
I think that's it.
So, if y'all have any more questions about everything we talked about tonight,
this smorgasbord of information.
Tweet at us at dungeon_caster.
Yeah, you can email us at dungeoncasterspodcast@gmail.com. Or check us out on iTunes, we're Dungeon Space Casters, under the podcast app.
I just want to say...
Alex, do you have anything to promote?
Yeah, you can just email me at my personal email. I'm not going to say it.
But if you find it...
I might say it. No, I'm not going to say it.
You don't want that.
I don't want that, no. But no, I just want to say thank you for inviting me out, and this has been a ton of fun.
Yeah, man. Absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
No, no problem.
Hey, Ben.
Yeah, dude.
Hey, Ben.
Yeah, dude.
Hey, Ben.
Yes, please tell me the joke.
What do you call an angry archer?
Any idea?
An angry orchard?
No.
Orchard?
Archer.
An angry archer.
Bowman.
Why the... No, that doesn't make any sense. Why the long bow?
No.
It's a sad archer.
A cross bowman.
A sad archer.
A what?
A cross bowman.
Oh.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now,
but that's
Alex,
not an archer.
When that cross bowman gets afraid and runs away, how does he do it?
Wait, hold on. Is this an extension of the same joke?
Yes.
So, when an angry archer...
Yeah. Gets scared and runs
gets
away.
Scared and runs
how
away.
Does he do
how
it?
Does he do it? With his feet. Or her feet.
Or the centaur hooves that they may or may not have.
When a crossbowman runs away, he bolts.
Oh
shit,
yeah.
It was right there.
Damn, that was so obvious. I'm all red.
In this podcast, we used Achilles and News Sting by Kevin MacLeod of Accompetech.com, licensed under Creative Commons.